From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. Today, my guest is Alan Stewart, who is the lead engineer at SyncedUp. It's a startup that both him and I are working on. I am the fractional CTO, and he obviously is leading a small team of developers. We talk about Lord of the Rings. We talk about Conway's Law. And then we talk about this little struggle we have with code that no developer wants to touch and some ways in which we can bridge that gap. So enjoy the show. Alan Stewart, welcome to the CTO Podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I want to either talk about Conway's Law or Lord of the Rings. Which one should we do?
Well, I guess that depends on your audience. We can switch gears on your audience and have a fine 7-hour podcast if you'd like.
I do want to know what fascinates you about Lord of the Rings, though. So maybe tell me that.
Sure. Lord of the Rings has been kind of part of my life as long as I can remember. My mom was a fan of Tolkien's books, and so she read them to me when I was pretty young. And I remember seeing some of the cartoons that came out, the Rankin-Bass ones. And as I grew older, I came to appreciate more and more some of the themes and literary devices that were being used. And so it's just something that has a lot of depth to it that I appreciate and find surprising at times that all of it could come out of the head of one man.
Reminds me of talking to a 30-something who grew up with a Harry Potter anthology, but in no way comparable, in my opinion.
I do enjoy Harry Potter, and I am reading it with my daughter right now, so it's not the same. I don't think I haven't read any made-up languages that I can recall in Harry Potter.
What about Game of Thrones? Are you into that?
I haven't really gotten into that. I know there was a lot of to-do around the show in recent years, but just never quite caught my interest.
Did you ever get into Terry Pratchett novels?
I have not yet, although I have heard really good things, and it's on my bucket list.
Got it. Well, good luck with that. There's so many to choose from, and it's, I guess, the Discworld series is probably the place to start. And then, of course, Douglas Adams. That's like must read for any technical person.
I'll agree with that.
I think Douglas Adams has changed so many lives, it's ridiculous. So how are you keeping Lord of the Rings current? Are you rereading novels? Are you rewatching movies?
I do some of that.
There aren't any new novels coming out, right?
I don't think so. Not novels. So Christopher Tolkien published a bunch of his father's work posthumously. And I went through many years being a fan of Lord of the Rings. I liked the Jackson movies that came out. And I had just never quite gotten into the Silmarillion. But then my sister-in-law turned me onto a podcast that I started listening to where they talk about basically walk through the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, the Lord of the Rings. And they go in depth in some of these other areas. So there's definitely a lot you can read. On my shelf behind me, I've got most of the history of Middle Earth, and I've been working my way through those. And it's a lot. It's sometimes more academic than novel, but I really enjoyed getting into the Silmarillion, Beren and Lúthien, some of what he called the great tales.
Yeah, I don't know what those words mean. Silmarillion.
Yeah, so the Silmarillion was basically a collection of stories that Tolkien never got around to publish it. He tried. He really wanted to publish it together with Lord of the Rings, but it never happened. And so later on, his son compiled, going through various versions, you know, many, many revisions of these stories, and came up with what he felt was a good version, but not perfect, of his father's intent, and published it to the world.
Well, something that you might really appreciate is that I've been to Tolkien's house in South Africa. He was born in a town called Bloemfontein. My wife is from that area. We went to his house. It's an incredibly modest little, I don't know when he left South Africa, but I think he was born there in the late 1800s.
He was pretty young when he left and went back to England, but that's really cool. I don't get a lot of international travel in, but I'd love to do more, and it'd be fun to see that.
Yeah, it was really crazy there's a lot of little hobbits that try to get in the house, and I can see where he drew his. Great. Well, thank you for that. I really love those novels. I read some of them. I didn't read all of them, but definitely had a profound impact on my imagination and all that.
Me too.
So are you right now, are you in the middle of reading something, or is it just part of your LLM?
A little bit of both. I read kind of sporadically. I will go for weeks without picking up a book, and then I'll sit down and read a whole novel. So it kind of comes in spurts for me. But I have been making my way through the fifth volume of The History of Middle Earth most recently, and that's kind of what I've been reading lately.
Just to cap this topic, can you just tell me what Middle Earth, what is the middle in Middle Earth? Because when I think of Middle Earth, I think of middleware, and or I think of the upside down, or I think of, like, I've never really understood what Middle Earth meant. Is it just the name of that world, or is there something more significant about it?
Well, it basically just means Earth. But as Tolkien was wont to do, rather than just use modern English to describe a thing, he went back to more archaic terms. We can still see this in other media. So if you are familiar with like Norse mythology, or even just watching Marvel's Thor, they'll talk about Midgard. And the mid there is the same as Middle Earth. So really, they're talking about Earth, but in kind of a cosmology of different places.
Got it. Fascinating. I think you've just helped an infinite loop kind of come to rest in my brain. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. Well, you and I work together. I'm helping a company as a CTO, and you're a lead engineer at this company. And I know we don't talk about Lord of the Rings at all. So this is a nice little catch up. But I want to talk about Conway's Law. It's something that comes up quite a bit, even as we're designing our organizations and thinking about software. So for people who hear the phrase mentioned a lot, people who think they understand what it means, can you dig in a little bit and just share what it means and how it affects our software development efforts?
Sure. A computer programmer named Melvin Conway kind of came up with this idea. And so that's why we call it Conway's Law. And what he said is that organizations that produce systems, they design systems, are constrained to produce designs which are copies of their communication structures. And so what that means to me is basically that the people aspect of developing software gets encoded into the software in some form or fashion, and that you really can't ignore that. And so if you try to divorce the people and who is working on your teams and how you structure your teams and how you reward them and these various things, how they communicate, that ends up somehow in the software, even if you don't intend it to. And so when you start thinking about systems architecture, especially distributed systems, you'll see those same kinds of communication patterns occur.
Yeah, it's really interesting for me because the first thing that comes to mind for me is the startup or the entrepreneur or the founder who is trying to bring an idea to life, a concept, a potential MVP, a fairly standard practice, and something that I do recommend to people often is to outsource offshore the development of the concept, like try get something to market as quickly as you can to see if there is some sort of fit. And Conway's law would suggest that, well, if you're outsourcing it to a team that has sporadic, inconsistent communication, maybe it's a sweatshop, maybe you're getting dollars shaved off the hourly rate because of how that team is organized, that is going to be reflected in the code base that you're purchasing as a founder from that team. Is that how you see it?
Yes, absolutely. And that doesn't mean that it's a bad idea or a wrong way to go about it. You just have to recognize that all of the software developed under that context have some aspect of that embedded into it, right? So the way that the people go about doing their work, and that could be anything from, you know, whether they do unit testing or even how they're incentivized, ends up in the code. And so although you as a founder, as a CTO, you love your product and you have this dream and this vision of how it's going to be, under the hood, it might not be as clean as you wish it were. Under the hood, it might not reflect the same convictions or disciplines or even language that you use. So in the product, you might have certain terminology that completely disappears once you get under the code. And that can make it more difficult to make changes and for the product to really have that ubiquitous language that lets you talk about something in terms of the product and the developer understands what you're talking about because they're not doing a mental translation into code speak.
I'm stuck on the word incentivized. A couple things I want to say. One, when you are in a hurry, the customer wants something delivered by some deadline, there is an incentive to get something done as quickly as possible in order to be able to secure the continuous invoicing for the work. And then, of course, the dev shop can keep going. There's probably a liberal use of structures, a liberal mapping of ideas to models, creating new models because there's a little exception that needs to be handled. So you kind of copy one model into another one because the incentive doesn't exist to do it thoughtfully inside of, say, an existing model. The incentive is, hey, the client is going to want to see a certain number of things on the app. And the shortest path to getting it done is to quickly copy this chunk of code, copy it to another section, make the modifications and get that out. And then to the client or to the founder, it's like, wow, it took you guys one sprint to create the something module. And meanwhile, ostensibly, that looks like it was done speedily with maybe some good quality because you copied code that maybe had some good checks and balances in it. But ultimately, you have signed yourself up for a horrific duplication of work and variables and memory allocation and controllers, whatever's involved in making that module work. Is that what you mean by sort of this incentive?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is one of the incentives. An offshore team, they're looking for money. In most cases, like they're not employed by you directly. Like they're not a member of your startup. They don't worry about the problems of your startup. They worry about the problems of their business, which is to keep money coming in for their development. Oftentimes, that'll be in a kind of a project mindset, that there's this amount of work that has been purchased. And so we're going to continue to work on each one of them. And every change order is great for them, right? Because now they're making money again. That's what they're incentivized to do. And they're not incentivized to be thinking holistically about the code base and how it ought to function as a kind of a complete whole, because they're not thinking about it as a product. That doesn't only happen with outsourcing. A CTO who has their developers in-house also has to consider, what are they incentivizing their developers to do? Are they worried about the feature treadmill and just get things out as quickly as they can? It's the dynamics are a little bit different in how money is transferred and whatnot, but a lot of those incentivizations really matter, right? It goes back to the people. How do you communicate? How do you work? What kind of culture do you have around what's important within the code? Is it important to you to have quality that you build in and you're willing to go back and make changes to old features to make them more uniform with new features? Or are you pushing more, just keep stacking on the features at any cost?
Yeah, and what comes to mind for me is this concept that when you are in the early stage and you really just have a founder with a dream and you cast your dream onto the altar of the dev shop, you really have to rely on the dev shop to do great work. And you have an inability personally to know if the work that is being delivered is normalized quality work. Now, I agree with you, when the CTO comes in, or a technical lead, or sometimes in many cases a product manager, there still could be the challenge that the work isn't being, I don't want to say audited, but I can see how there could be, and I'm even convicted myself, whereas I'm fully trusting that our development team at SyncedUp is just delivering good quality code. I mean, I'm not going to go through the code and audit the work that was done.
Well, I appreciate that. I'd like to think if you did audit it, it would come out with flying colors, but it's nice to have the trust. And I think that there's a certain amount of that you're going to have to have. You can't personally go in and control everything as things progress. And so you have to get clear on what things are important and what do you communicate. And then you see whether the results, the outcomes that are being produced by the developers, does that actually match up with your principle? And if not, you can look and see, are you incentivizing them to do things in a way that is suboptimal? Or maybe there's some other aspect of that communication or people structure that is causing it to not turn out quite the way that you wanted.
What have you seen in code bases that just is a reflection of bad incentives? So we just briefly talked about the hurry up and deliver incentive, providing you with maybe a lot of copied code, slight variations in the way the models are. You may have 6 or 7 things modeling the same exact concept just because there's a little variation or a slight change in behavior. Are there other things that maybe CTOs listening to this can say, wow, I wonder, there's this incentive of sizzle features, constantly building features. What have you seen, if any, symptoms or issues in the code that you're like, oh, okay, I can tell that this company is driven by X, Y, or Z motivation?
Well, one that comes to mind is just going in and looking at what kind of automated testing exists, because I've seen a lot of different incentivizations or even disincentivization, where a manager will say, no, don't spend time writing tests. That's not what I pay you for, or we've got a QA team to do that, or something else. And so now we're starting to look at communication structures again, right? Like it goes back to Conway's law. If you are communicating to them saying, no, don't spend your time on this, well, you don't build up your regression suite. But worse, what I found is that untested code often brings a lot of fear. And so the developers look at this code and they say, I don't fully understand it. And it's getting more and more complex. And there's no tests to give me confidence that if I were to make a change, that change would be okay. And so I'm just going to let it stay. And if I have to touch that code, I'm going to do it as carefully, as surgically as possible without changing anything and hope that my new changes just can kind of layer on top. As opposed to if you have tests, it drives out the fear and you are open to rewriting sections of code. Instead of thinking about it as like this big rewrite where you're going to change everything all at once, it's more of a continual change where any time that something doesn't quite fit, you say, oh, well, you know, this square peg and this round hole just don't quite fit together. Well, you can make a change so that they do fit at the time that it matters rather than waiting until it just becomes unbearable, at which point it's usually very hard to make that change.
Yeah, and I think the sad thing about that is when you have a founder-led offshore team, they won't necessarily know that this is something that they should be asking from their development team.
Yeah, well, and even sometimes when it seems good, they have a QA team or SQE, SRE, some kind of team that sounds good on paper, but you have to consider what does that mean as far as the dynamics of that communication. If the QA person is sitting down with the developer and they're working together, you're going to have a very different outcome from the developer is trying to finish the feature and pass it over the wall to the QA person who's going to test it. And then they just keep rejecting it and saying, no, no, there's a problem. No, there's a problem until, you know, they go back and forth competitive volleyball style until somebody spikes it and says, ha, I win. It's less collaborative. And what you're going to see in the code is going to be a lot more
aggressive coding,
I guess defensive, right? Yeah. The code is doing just enough to pass the tests rather than thinking about an inherent aspect of quality.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. Is there a way for a CTO to just know whether the quality of the code is good? And by implication, my question is, a lot of times founders will come to me and say, man, we feel really suspicious about not only our code quality, but are we being overbilled for, how do we know that the work is good? You know, lines of code obviously is not a measure. Frequency of push is really not a, is not a measure. What I have going on in my mind right now is should there be, for the smaller startup and maybe even larger, should there be reading sessions where you all sort of pick a random part of the code base and you just read it together mob style? Or how can CTOs who are further removed from the actual coding know that what is being produced is of high quality so that they can say, hey, you know what, let's buy some more time because I don't agree that this is the best way to do it. And then the developers all sigh a sigh of relief saying, great, well, CTO just bought us some more time to do this a better way instead of just being okay with what is coming down the pike from the developers. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. And unfortunately, it can be difficult to see. The software world is one of abstractions stacked on top of each other ad nauseum. So it can be really difficult to see, because when you actually open up your web browser or your mobile app or whatever it is, you're only seeing kind of a thin layer of what the product really is. And so depending on your skill as a leader, as a founder, a CTO, if you are a technical co-founder, you might have the ability to go in and see some of those things yourself, right? You could do a code reading and you can get a sense for it yourself. But if you don't have that, I think you kind of have to find some people that you trust, and maybe you get a second opinion, you know, have somebody come in and do a technical audit for you. And it doesn't even have to be very formal, right? It's like, hey, let me share my source code with somebody that I know and trust. And they take a few hours and just kind of give you their general sense. I found a lot of programmers can very quickly, after they have a few years of experience, they've been through a few different code bases, they can very quickly give you a thumbs up, thumbs down sentiment of, would I want to work in this code? And if they say, no, I wouldn't want to work in this code, then you can kind of start peeling back and ask why. So having someone you trust, I think, can help. There are some other indicators. They are lagging indicators, so you have to be careful that you're monitoring it. But how long does it take to develop new features is a good indication, because every new feature that you add adds another layer of complexity. And so it's going to naturally take longer. But if it's taking exponentially longer each time, that often is a sign that there are a lot of hidden constraints under the hood that is causing it to be more and more difficult to continue. It's very hard to have that initial velocity that you get at the very beginning of a project where you can just start doing things and you go from nothing to something. But going from something to something else or something more is slower. And so, like I said, it's a lagging indicator, and you kind of have to watch it carefully, because it's going to drop naturally. But if it drops too much, that may be an indication that you've got too much complexity under the hood.
Yeah, and that is something that the founders or the CEOs will reach out to me about as a first indicator, which is something that used to take a few weeks is now taking a few months, or we've been stuck on a release now for sometimes years where things have not been able to get pushed out to production. I think there is a responsibility for reading code together and just slowly, just like reading together. Ultimately, the assumption is that the CTO has ascended to the role rooted in years of coding. I just wonder, like, if I called you up, since we do work together, I call you up and I'm like, hey, Alan, let's do some code reading sessions together. What would you think about that?
I mean, I think it would be great. Most developers know where their pain points are. And so talking through it with them is a good way to understand what's going on. Depending on the level of trust, psychological safety that you've got going on, they may be hesitant, especially talking to a leader. There can be positional authority issues that cause them to clam up a little bit. But if you can get in and talk about it and try to be non-judgmental about how the code was being written, you can really learn a lot about the areas that they are struggling with.
Got it. If we bring this back to Conway's Law, what organizational structure, what development methodologies have you seen that produces the most crafted software, the most beloved output? And I know that you're a fan of mob programming, and I know we do mob programming at SyncedUp, but you've obviously have a long career in software development. What types of organizational setups have you seen that benefits code quality versus those that detract from code quality?
I think one of the biggest signals for me has been around collaboration, which is part of the reason why I like pair and mob programming. It's not limited just to the developers. It's also a collaboration between the product people and the testers and the operations team. And so you get hints of, in agile circles, you'll call it the cross-functional team. Or in other circles, you'll talk about it in terms of DevOps. and bringing together these disciplines and helping everybody to understand a little bit better about what the others contribute. And ideally, get a little bit of cross-training so that it doesn't have to be throwing things over the wall to the other person and hope that they understand it and catch it and handle it correctly. But they are an active participant in the co-creation of the product. So that's probably what comes to mind first of all for me. Another thing that comes to mind is really around the culture of the engineering team. What matters to them? Do they talk about the principles behind the practices that they use? Or are they just kind of cargo culting whatever practice that they've got going on? Either this is how we've always done it, or we heard that Netflix does it this way, or Google does it this way, and so we're going to do it that way too. Some of that rationale can be pretty feeble, really. And it doesn't bring in the context of your business and what you're doing. If you are building a streaming service that's going to have, you know, audio and video, and it's going to go out to millions of people at a time, then yeah, copying what Netflix is doing might actually be a good thing. But if you're a small startup who is in a completely different space, you don't want to be cargo culting all of the practices that Netflix has, because they don't apply to your situation.
Yeah, I find that to be so true for almost everything, leadership and topology. And a lot of blog posts go out and people get excited about a certain way of doing things, and then it's just not beneficial for the specific problems the company is solving.
Yeah. So I really like looking at the principles, because there are some things that tend to hold true. Principles like collaboration, principles like quality through automated testing, those hold true in a lot of scenarios. Using source control, right? Like that's using source control is about the only context-free piece of advice that I would give to any developer. I don't care what you're doing, put it under source control so that you can see your changes and rescue yourself later when you make a bad change.
We don't do source control. We do live edits on the website, on the app.
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of even the term best practices. It gets thrown around, but very rarely do you hear somebody say, best for what? This is the best practice for talking about best practices, I guess. Right? It's like, well, what are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to achieve quality? There are practices that help you with quality. Are you trying to improve the communication within your code so that people understand it better and that they are more willing to work and edit in that code? There are different practices that you pick up depending on which thing that you value the most.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the idea that when we spoke a little bit about open collaboration, which includes potentially on product and brings more people into the conversation, there could be a resistance. And I've actually seen this resistance where some people feel like, hey, I don't really want to be in the product conversations. I don't have much to say. I don't want to agonize over, is this a feature that's been validated? Is this a true reflection of what the market wants? I don't want to be in those conversations. I just want to code, and I want to know that what I'm working on has meaning. And I don't actually appreciate this whole, let's get everybody in a room all the time kind of vibe.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that. Depending on what's going on within a company and how many developers there are too, right? Like if you've got 8 developers that you're all bringing all of them into the same room, some of them just probably aren't going to say anything for the entire call, just because there's already too many active voices that they can't make their thoughts heard, even if they have something valuable to share. So I do think that there's some underlying problems there that you have to consider. Why are they not wanting to speak up? Or how are they feeling about it? One thing that I found sometimes happens is that product can get way ahead of development. And so the company is building up an inventory of ideas, and it feels cheap, but it really has the same kinds of problems as having a big inventory if you we're running like a warehouse. And so there's lots and lots of ideas. Sometimes it's just as simple as, I don't care about this feature because I know for sure we're not going to build it in the next 3 months because the product team is just so far ahead of the development team. They don't want to spend all day dreaming about what we could maybe do in the future instead of what we could actually be coding right now.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that observation about, you know, sometimes you're going to have these developers on the call and they're not going to say anything. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think the reasons that you're giving are valid. You're right. Sometimes the product people are way ahead and the devs like, well, whatever I contribute now could change in the next couple months because everything has changed. So why contribute? So I understand this idea that we want to bring people into the conversation as much as we can, but I think there's probably too much of that as well. And one should just find that balance.
Yeah. And so then it becomes a question of how are people collaborating, right? Good collaboration doesn't mean necessarily that you all have to be in the same room doing all the same things at the same time. I think that there is room for breaking up. There is room for specialists to focus on the thing that they're really good at. And sometimes some developers just don't want to do product things just because they don't have that specialty. That's not something that they gravitate toward. But I do think that there has to be some mechanism where you're pulling it together and you are collaborating. And even if it's just an acknowledgement that as a developer, I just don't really care. I don't want to be on a customer call. Maybe that's okay, as long as there's some other mechanism going on where they are able to get the insight into what the customer needs, what they want, what problems they're having. It doesn't necessarily have to be all collaboration. Everybody has to be part of that same call all the time.
Very good. I love that. Let's close out with a question that we spoke about a bit earlier, which is that code base that everyone's afraid to touch. I remember many, many years ago, I built a content management system. This is in the early 2000s. And I coded the thing from scratch. And one of the things I coded was a very sexy little recursive generator for the ULLI linked list in HTML. And it worked really well. It was for nested menus and stuff. It was great. But the code was, you know, if you think about the CMS, every single website we were deploying had a menu structure. And so thousands of websites relied on this piece of recursive code to generate a menu system. And I don't know if things have changed, but ULLI lists were actually very weird. There were some issues around closed tags and open tags and all that. And I remember as my development team grew, I'm talking past 10 plus people, no one wanted to touch that code. And it became a very big problem when we decided to build draggable, droppable menus for people. And for years and years and years, we never built a drag and drop menu organizer because no one, including myself, wanted to touch that code. And I think ultimately, one brave soul actually went ahead and actually we ran a small competition inside of our company to say, all things being equal, go and build a brand new menu design feature for our CMS. And one guy did it. And I think he even won an early iPad back in those days. But if someone came to you and said, we have this chunk of code that is untouched and untouchable and has the shame of the organization on it, how would you go about addressing that?
Well, two of the problems that I commonly see in situations like that are fear and context changing, and sometimes both, right? Like they go together. So like in your example, there's probably some fear around that code. I don't know whether it was well tested or not, or like if you had like unit tests or whatever. But even if it had tests, there's this other level of fear that Etienne created this. It's his baby. He just called it sexy. And I don't think that I'm supposed to touch anything that he thinks is sexy. So there would be a fear there. And it's interesting you said that you ended up creating a competition because now you're driving out the fear and incentivizing people by being really explicit. It's like, I want you to change this thing. I want a new version of it. And I'm giving you a reason to do it that may not have existed before. So fear is something that can happen. And there's a number of ways you can drive out fear. Unit tests is one of the biggest ones that have worked for me, but also just culturally, making sure that they're not afraid to change things. And if something breaks, the first person who touches it and it breaks and you fire them, well, you've just guaranteed that nobody's going to touch it again. So there's a cultural fear that you got to address as well. And then the other one is just the context. Your example highlights that as well, right? At one point, UL and UI tags inside the HTML were the way to do a menu system. And so it fit the problem really well. Over time, the context changed and there were new HTML tags and there were new CSS things that people wanted to do. Driving out that problem, I've often found it being a question of abstractions and getting good at understanding how you separate your code so that different concerns are addressed. Like there's this concern of, well, we need a menu structure, and then there's how you write it in the HTML. And if you can create well-factored pieces of code that follow some of these other principles, like solid principles, which incidentally fit really well into functional programming as well, not just the object-oriented style that they kind of originated in. But if you're following some of those practices, then you have the opportunity to branch by abstraction and say, oh, well, this has a different kind of menu. And so we're just going to plug in a different menu renderer into the code. But it takes some discipline. It takes some experience and thought to be able to arrive at that. And a lot of developers don't have that experience and they won't know that that was the thing to do unless you really call out, hey, these are some of those principles that we care about and we're willing to experiment in our code.
Yeah. And one of my developers was always quick to tell me, hey, you know, I can go and change stuff, but I know that it's my nights and weekends if I break the code. You said it in a reasonable way. It's like, hey, the impact of your sexy code is that I go and try and fix it or improve it or modernize it, and it leads to thousands of broken sites, or in the pool of thousands of sites, one or two exceptions or sort of outside edge cases. That I like that. And ultimately, the hackathon competition that I created did eventually produce an upgraded system. To your point, I think it allayed all our developers' fears, the fear about touching the code, when they saw one of their colleagues actually do something that at least showed everybody what could be done. Of course, there were questions about deploying and upgrading and all that, but I think that immediately just calmed people as to, okay, wow, this can actually be done. It was done in a super creative way and ultimately did lead to the upgrade of the system. Great. Well, Alan, thanks for the insights. Dev Insights.
You're welcome.
I will talk to you soon again.
I look forward to it.
That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.